welcome to this week's The Weekly Pulse Sunday. I'm Jeff Snyder, founder and CEO of The Morning Pulse, joined by my co-hosts, one from Arizona, Mr. George Grombacher, and coming to us from New York City, she's the Motley Fool's tech reporter, Miss Natalie Walters. Guys, how are you today?
Doing great, man. Doing great.
Doing great.
Yeah, so
thanks
we're
for having me again.
Great to have you on, Natalie, and George, great to catch up with you. And we're coming from three different locations. We're actually coast to coast this week. We've got some great guests. Really excited about this. And I know you guys have been busy with your own work. George, you have your own podcast, The Money Savage. And I know last week kind of highlighted some of the things you learned from your travails that week. How about this week? What did you pick up on in your interviews with some of your guests?
Yeah, we had three solid shows this week. A gentleman named Jeffrey Levine, I think that he is in your neck of the woods, talking about different tax trip-ups that people, or tax mistakes that people commonly make when they're doing retirement planning. So that was excellent. Had an executive coach and speaker named David Rendell on, talking about how you should maybe stop worrying about your weaknesses so much and start focusing on your strengths. And then lastly, had a lady named Stacy Boston talking about the practice of contentment. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with that practice or not, but I found it to be very, very valuable over the years. And I know that later in the show today, we're going to be talking with Jacob Passy about how two-thirds of Americans are anxious about paying their bills. And something tells me that a little bit more contentment in our lives could help to alleviate that anxiety. So that, it was a good week.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really interested to learn more. I did see you, obviously you post on LinkedIn and iTunes. I did see the podcast on contentment. I'm really interested in that because, I think I agree. I think, we live in a very anxious society where we're always trying to achieve more and more. We're a consumer-based society. And what did you take away from that? Can you share a little bit before we get into it with Jacob?
Yeah, I think that one of the easiest ways to boil the practice of contentment down is simply to be mindful of when we're wanting things that are more than we currently have, or better than we currently have, or different. More, better, different. Why do I want those things? Is it just because I've been influenced by media or something outside of me, or is it something that I really do want? The practice of contentment is not contrary to ambition and wanting to be successful. It's simply just being really mindful about why it is that I'm thinking about consuming something. So,
yeah, I think I think perspective's very important. And I actually watched, we obviously don't promote any products or services or anything on the show, but I happened to watch something on Netflix the other day. It's called Endgame. I don't know if it's kind of new to Netflix, and it really is about the end of life. And that helped me kind of shape my perspective a little bit, because sometimes you can be in the trenches, we're running around the country, we're doing our jobs, we're in the middle of our lives, and then you see this end game, this end of life and what that's like, and it really says, where are we all going and what's important? And that really made me personally pause and say, what's important to me? And, so obviously, I think at all points in our lives, we kind of need to reprioritize.
No doubt.
Yeah.
How's your perspective these days, Natalie?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I think that's true. Especially someone who's young and living in a city, it's sometimes hard to focus on long-term and to save money. I'm looking at it for a new apartment right now, and, it's tough to kind of sacrifice short-term pleasures like a bigger place for long-term financial health. I actually saw a really interesting story this morning in the New York Post that said the lady who has the lowest rent in NYC just passed away this week, and her rent was $28 a month.
Wow.
Because she was living in a rent-controlled, Greenwich Village apartment, which is really a nice area, and she's lived there since 1955, and all the ways they tried to kind of kick her out to get more money from other people, it just never worked. She stuck it out, so inspiration for myself.
Yeah, Wanting things now. I appreciate what you're saying very much. So important to be mindful of it.
So Nat, what's going on in the tech world? I know you have a couple of really top three stories that you kind of picked out this week. What's top of mind for you and the folks over at the Motley Fool?
Yeah, thanks. So the news I was focusing on this week has to do with Walmart and Flipkart. They finally closed that deal. Walmart is paying $16 billion for a 77% stake in Flipkart. And if you didn't know, Flipkart's India's largest e-commerce company. So Walmart's trying to get, you know, this head start there. But a lot of shareholders are not super thrilled about it. And the stock was actually down in the news because they're thinking, why are you spending $16 billion for this company? You're not even sure it'll work. You know, Flipkart's still losing money. And Amazon already has a great business in India that's growing really fast. So they're not really sure why Walmart has done this huge deal. I mean, before this deal, Walmart's biggest purchase was Jet.com for $3.3 billion. And that's just so much less. So it's kind of caused some controversy this week. I think, you know, we did know this was coming. It's been a few months or so that we've been expecting it. But it's interesting to see it finally close and to see how people are reacting to it.
Yeah, these things take a lot of time to gestate, I would imagine. And just kind of hearing and watching from the outside, definitely not on the inside, you know, the Snap IPO and others, acquisitions take a lot of due diligence, a lot of time. And I would imagine these technology companies take a lot of more due diligence to figure out their quote-unquote model and their profitability and what that can mean when you kind of marry to a right. traditional organization like Walmart.
It's interesting how we were just talking about instant gratification versus waiting a little bit, and you wonder if the pressure on Walmart to keep up in India with Amazon led them into making this kind of a decision, but who knows? Time will tell.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a great point because Walmart was trying to tell their shareholders, you know, if we were just a company that expected to be alive the next 3 to 5 years, then sure, we wouldn't have made this purchase. So we want to be around long term. So we think it's going to be worth it in the long run. You know, India is the second largest country in the world, 1.3 billion people, and it's a very young country. I think I saw half of that population is under 25. So that's going to be what they hope will be a huge economic driver, you know, in the future. So it's going to be interesting to see Walmart try to fight Amazon there. I mean, Amazon has so much more money to kind of take over India. And actually just last month in Jeff Bezos' annual letter, he made a point to say that their Amazon India business is the fastest growing e-commerce platform in India. So while it's still making less money than Flipkart right now, Amazon's India platform is growing faster than Flipkart. So it could overtake it, you know, in the next few years.
Wow. Well, be interesting to see how that all kind of transpires, because that battle for retail supremacy is going to continue from here into probably to eternity.
Oh, for sure. yeah. If I could just add one more thing there, it's fascinating to me. I think you said that half the population is under the age of 25, and that's an interesting demographic. I have no idea what the United States is, but I don't think that that's the same. So,
no, I think what's interesting when you look at the demographics of the U.S. and even China, it's an aging population. Mm-hmm. China especially, I think that's one of the biggest concerns when you read some of these articles on pensions and whatnot. So, I think more to see. There's going to kind of a realigning, if you will, maybe of some of these quote-unquote emerging markets, and that'll have an impact on for generations.
No doubt.
So, Natalie, Nat, you were going to watch The Avengers last week. We had talked a little bit about MoviePass. some news on MoviePass, and I don't think this has anything to do with your lack of being able to see the Avengers movie, but you have an update on them.
Yes. So if you don't know, MoviePass is the subscription system where you can pay $10 a month and you can basically see a movie a day. And really the only downside is you have to be close to the theater in order to actually purchase your tickets. You can't really be at home when you purchase it, which is why I sometimes don't end up using it. But everyone has been saying, you know, how can this business stay afloat? It doesn't make sense. You know, how can you just pay $10 a month and see 30 movies a month when usually one ticket costs $15 nowadays? And it turns out they're losing about $20 million a month. And So it kind of makes sense. But, you know, now shareholders are kind of freaking out. I think some people were thinking, well, maybe they have this, maybe we don't know their secret or something. But, you know, money is money, and they're not making enough money right now. But it's still interesting that the company seems confident that they're going to be fine. They said, you know, we're going to have 5 million subscribers by the end of 2018, and that will make us profitable. And so they feel that this is appealing enough that they'll get 5 million subscribers, and that will push them into profitability. So it'll be interesting to see. It's such a unique model, and it does seem too good to be true. So I'm interested to see how this plays out. And obviously, I'm a MoviePass subscriber, so I hope it sticks around because it's a great deal for myself.
Yeah, that is. Time will tell on that one as well. So perhaps get out and see a movie this weekend.
I know a lot of people that were trying to get into MoviePass, and then actually a few weeks ago they ended the $10 a month subscription, and a lot of people thought it was because they were losing so much money on it, but they actually brought it back last week and said that they, you know, just worked through a few technical glitches. You know, now it's you can't share one MoviePass between two people now. They've kind of upped their security on that, so now they feel confident again. So we'll see.
We will see. Well, Natalie, thanks as always for the information.
Thanks. Yep. Yes, thanks so much, guys. Always great to talk to you.
Yeah, have a great weekend. Enjoy the great weather in New York, and we'll talk to you next week.
Talk to you guys soon.
Bye, Natalie.
Bye.
Welcome back. Joining us now are our two favorite Wall Street gentlemen, Oliver Rennick from TD Ameritrade and Kevin Kelly from Bloomberg. We were just talking about how everybody's in a good mood on Friday. Has that translated to the stock market? Oliver Rennick.
Today it's a little mixed, but this week has been pretty interesting once again. I mean, market largely has been pretty resilient as far as just benchmark equity indexes. S&P is cruising back up towards 2750, and the strength has kept on materializing. There's a lot of things you can point to. In short, I would just say that the thesis that I found to be the most compelling that I think we talked about before, about a week and a half ago when I was talking about the dollar, it continues to be, I think, the clearest sort of read-through on what's happening around the world. And in short, it is a surprisingly divergent central bank policy and surprisingly divergent economic scenario for the U.S. versus the rest of the world that essentially has put a sort of cap on the speed at which yields here are going to move higher, I think, which is why you have the 10-year muddling around 3. I think expectations and concerns were that it was gonna pop quicker, but as long as you've got Draghi and Kuroda and Mark Carney and everyone else kind of twiddling their thumbs, we see a lot more closer of a market to kind of what we got used to for a long time. But of course, then you continue to see that yield curve flatten because our Fed is going to go. So what does all that mean? Basically, it means that things are changing, but they're changing more slowly than a lot of people thought. And that means that a very equity-positive environment is not flipping overnight. This week, we saw companies like JP Morgan show some strength. We saw companies like Google show some strength. Stocks that got sold off on earnings despite having really solid fundamental growth. So wouldn't be surprised to see some more of that. But until then, we're basically just kind of looking to see how all this economic data comes in if it derails that thesis.
Yeah, and I would say, I mean, to Oliver's point, it's been an interesting market this week. We are up on the week. We're starting to put in a little bit of green on the screen, which is always good to see. A lot of that's been led by some of the cyclical names that, you know, we've touched on this show that we've been looking to see a bit of a recovery in. These are ones that are like the technology sector, but more so industrials, materials, those types of sectors, because they do make up a large part of the market. So it's a difficult environment to get, you know, higher prices on the S&P or equities in general without, you know, a lot of those stocks ending up doing well. I would also note, I mean, we're talking about yield curve. I agree. I think things are moving a bit slower, even though, you know, there is a lot of rhetoric out there right now what this yield curve flattening is going to mean for the market. We've done some work on this, and really until you see, you know, that inversion that we've been talking about or highlighting, until you see that, I mean, it is a good market historically for equity returns. we recently came out and looked at kind of where we were, or try to put an idea of where we are in the cycle. We think we're more towards the later end of this cycle, which isn't anything new. A lot of people have been saying that. But what is interesting is the characteristics of what, you know, a late cycle would look like for stocks. And that's higher volatility, which we've seen creep into the market. We're still rising prices, but again, in a more volatile market, some of those returns we become so accustomed to might be a little bit more suppressed. So it's not a negative outlook on equities, but you know, you're probably not expecting the, you know, 20% returns year over year that we've seen in years past.
Got it. We were just talking in the segment earlier about how Walmart has made the acquisition of Flipkart, and how has the market responded to that?
Pretty interesting stuff. Walmart is not going down easy. They continue to fight. The stock has not been rewarded at all since their past earnings, which, by the way, they sold off because, what was it, a 20% growth rate was not enough for Jet.com, for the market. I mean, again, this is a company that is, I think it surprised a lot of people over the past year and a half how they've responded to the Bezos Amazon empire, but it's definitely had a rough 2018 for sure. This is, again, just a story of disruption, and who sort of comes out on top? The Flipkart deal is pretty interesting. India is obviously thought of as many as the next great growth opportunity after China. And for them, that's important. They also recently sold off a business in England that they had been sort of playing around with and trying. So they are clearly trying to be nimble, a lot more nimble than a lot of people thought. But if you look at the chart, I mean, it's kind of back towards late 2017 levels. So it's been tough for Walmart to convince the street.
I think what's notable there, too, is just the precedent it sets for the rest of the retail industry in general. I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of beating a dead horse talking about the Amazon effect for a lot of these brick and mortar focused retailers. But we are starting to see a lot of them come out and try and innovate in different ways. Or you might see an environment where that's ripe for more, you know, mergers and acquisition activity, you know, to the Walmart point, because these companies either have to innovate in-house and start to compete with, you know, a more more internet focused consumer, or, you know, they simply kind of roll over and die. So it'll be interesting to see if there's more of this activity and if this sets a precedent.
Hey, guys. This is Jeff here. So one of the things I wanted to ask you about is commodities, and specifically oil. And noticed that just reading the news that – or seeing the news that oil prices have spiked. I don't know if that's you're tied. I guess it is tied in some ways to pulling out of the U.S.-Iranian treatise or whatever you want to call it to not produce nuclear weapons, and some of the things that are going on between – Israel and Syria. But thoughts about, you know, we're coming up on Labor Day, people are going to be driving. Just any thoughts about the commodity prices and specifically oil?
Yeah, we've been talking about it. Go ahead, Kevin. No, Kevin, you take this one.
Right.
You go.
Hot potato. Did I stump the professor?
So, yeah, no. Great point. And something we're definitely watching, especially as it comes to the energy stocks, which have done, you know, have done well recently, but have pretty much lagged this rally in oil really since, you know, June of this past summer. And part of that is because I think, you know, investors and the market's a little bit skeptical that prices could stay this high on oil. You're right in pointing out there's a lot of geopolitical risk that's kind of starting to be factored in more so on the supply side. But kind of linking this back to Oliver's opening comments about the dollar, you're seeing an environment right now where the dollar continues to rise while oil does. And historically, they've had a negative relationship because oil's priced in dollars for the most part, or a majority of it's priced in dollars. And as the dollar rises, you know, that'll oftentimes inhibit demand at a certain point. So I think one of those, that decoupling from that historical relationship, I think one of those is going to have to break first. But yeah, at least in the short term, unless this geopolitical tension kind of slows down, I mean, you could see oil maintain these levels.
I knew Kevin was going to go the energy stock route. And I like it.
You call me predictable there, Big O?
No, you're an equity guy, you know. You're sticking your ballpark, and, you know, I respect that. No, I'm just kidding.
Nice.
The energy stock story is super, super fun. I think Kevin put it pretty well. I don't have a whole lot to add, but this has been a fascinating move to watch in the price of oil for sure. what I would say is that while Jeff, you're definitely right, and as Kevin talked about with the geopolitical concerns, I think that has kind of been a cherry on top of something bigger. So while you're going to hear a lot about geopolitics, and I think that's the go-to explanation, I'm a little bit suspect. I think that's been important the past couple weeks. You had a huge pop in volume the day that the Iran deal, the day that the president announced he'd be withdrawing from that deal. But, I mean, this is just a rally that has been relentless for a year. It's now almost double the price of crude from $42. So it's maybe a big economic growth story about just the demand for it. It is a story of, I think, shale companies that have been able to operate very efficiently. There's been a lot of supply put on. 10 million barrels a day is the expectation. But no matter what those companies do, there seems to be enough demand for it. There are certainly some dislocations, if you will, in the fundamental story that have some concern. And that's been particularly days in which we see inventories climb, yet the market rallies anyway. But it hasn't been super reliable. There has largely been a sufficient demand, at least right now. I think some of the deeper geopolitical issues with Venezuela and their supply goes back a little bit further than what we see with Iran right now. But it's hard for me to totally detach it from the overall economic picture and what people need. Eventually, it's gonna hit gas, to come back to your point, Jeff. And yeah, it'll be a little bit painful, but you know, supposedly people are doing better. So,
excellent.
One real quick final point to that, and it's just a technical thing, but it is a headwind that we're watching for. Is if you look at speculative positioning, right? So basically, just people betting on oil prices going higher. If you look at the futures market, the people that are long that or expecting that to increase are at record levels right now. So that, again, it's you kind of get this question of who's left to come in and buy from a futures and trading standpoint. That's something we're watching that could be a potential headwind and kind of caps this big rally we've seen.
Excellent. So where are you going, Kevin?
I'm flying home. I'm surprising my mother for Mother's Day. She has no idea I'm coming in.
Wow.
So
okay.
I'm hoping for a positive reaction, but,
you never know.
So far this year, you never know.
And Oliver, your mom obviously lives in New York because you're going to New York this weekend.
Right. Way to set me up, guys.
Boom!
Nice. Way to set me up. I'm doing the Pro Flowers route.
Excellent.
Nice.
Well done, gentlemen. Enjoy Mother's Day, wherever you may be.
Have a good trip, guys. Thank you.
Welcome back. Always enjoy getting the market updates from Kevin Kelly and Oliver Rennick. And something else I also really enjoy is getting an update on what is going on Capitol Hill with Kevin Walsh from the Groom Law Group. Welcome, Kevin. How are you?
Hey, Kev. I'm good. Thanks for having me on. It's always fun to be on this podcast.
So we know that always a lot going on, but what is the Fifth Circuit? What is going on there?
So I think you phrased it really well with what's going on, because I think by now everyone thought that the Fifth Circuit's vacatur, essentially killing the fiduciary rule, would have already been going on. The thought was that on May 7th, because the timing was May 7th, was the day that everyone thought the fiduciary rule was going to die. It turns out that as of now, this is Friday afternoon being recorded, that hasn't happened yet. So there's a decision that says it's going to go away, but for whatever reason, the judges who wrote that decision haven't formally entered the piece of paper saying, and it's done.
Wow.
Yeah, so I think there's kind of questions right now as to, is something going on, or is this just kind of an administrative delay? For now, I think we're thinking it's an administrative delay, but the longer this goes on, the more and more people will speculate that there's something going on behind the scenes.
And if you were to speculate that there was something going on behind the scenes, like what, just purely guesswork, what do you think that it would be?
I mean, my guess here is that it's that somebody is sitting on a piece of paper and that it's going to get filed at some point. So I'm a believer of the no conspiracy theory here, but if I were to really try to make something up and speculate what it could be, it could be that they're trying to see if the rest of the court wants to review the denial of the motion to intervene. I think it's really speculative to think that's what's going on. So I really don't think that's what's going on.
And I'm sorry, it's speculative. Yeah, I totally appreciate that. But what was it that the rest of the court wants to review?
So the rest of the so the Fifth Circuit on the whole could be taking the time on its own initiative to look at whether the panel got it right in denying the motions to intervene by AARP in the three states.
Got it.
I don't think that's what they're doing, but if I had to speculate and I had to say there was a conspiracy going on, that's the one that I'd buy into.
The grassy knoll, the magic bullets. Who knows, man? But odds are it's just that it's sitting on somebody's desk waiting to be rubber stamped or filed away and just hasn't happened yet. So
yeah. Kevin, could it be also have anything to do with the SEC's uniform fiduciary? Or is it really just a litigious factor? It's really just that court conversation that has to happen.
I think it's a court conversation that has to happen. I mean, I think we can come up with grassy knoll theories, which are fun, but I don't think the butler did it. I don't think there's a – yeah. We'll see.
Got it.
I mean, it'll be resolved the next few days either way.
Okay.
I think it's a delay, but if this lasts through next week, then maybe I'll come up with some good conspiracy theories.
I was going to say, if it carries on for too long, then yes, something.
Then we'll have David to make up conspiracy theories.
Yes.
And we should point out that David is taking a breather today. And you know, we of course have Kevin, and you know, Kevin keeps us in the loop. So we wish David well. We look forward to having him back. But Kevin, you're doing a fabulous job. And there's a lot less banter. Although we have a lot of banter coming from George and I too, which is bad.
So what's going on with the Department of Labor?
So this is kind of the other reason why I don't think there's a lot of action going on behind the scenes here. On Monday, essentially, the Department of Labor issued this transitional guidance. That seems designed to provide some relief for plan fiduciaries who are using some of the exemptions that are going to disappear when the court signs this piece of paper. And what the DOL said is if you're offering an advice program and you continue to comply with the impartial conduct standards, which are some of the core conditions of the best interest contract exemption, then we will not bring enforcement action. We will deem you to essentially have not engaged in a prohibited transaction for our purposes. And to me, if DOL thought that something was going on and this order wasn't going to come out, then they didn't really need to issue this guidance. But with the order coming out, it's helpful kind of for individual IRA holders. It makes it easier for them to continue to remain in the advice programs they're in, and it allows financial institutions to offer advice program still. So it's kind of a big deal, but it's only a big deal if this vacator actually goes through.
Kev, you're out talking to clients. You and David and the groom team are out talking to clients. I mean, is this frustrating? I mean, just from the outside looking in as an advisor consultant who specializes in retirement plans, kind of waiting for these rules. I've been waiting with bated breath. We've all been waiting, anticipating, and then this continues to kind of play itself out. But if you're a client and you need to kind of evaluate your vendors, I would imagine this can be a bit of, I don't know, frustrating is the right word, but it definitely puts off some of the due diligence you would need to do, I would imagine.
I mean, I think frustration is probably the right word. And some of it here is frustration over the uncertainty. And some of it's frustration that, I mean, some companies just spent a ton of resources developing compliance programs for this this difficult exemption, but it was an exemption that allowed them to offer advice programs and still get commissions. And essentially, there's some frustration that everything they developed might not be usable in the future. So I think that's a concern. On the other hand, there's frustration that we don't really have a settled standards. I mean, the standards have been changing frequently. You had a 2010 DOL proposal, a 2015 DOL proposal. The 2016 proposal went into effect in 2017. It got vacated. The judges decided to vacate it in March. The SEC released a proposal in April. I think there's frustration that, come on, like, we want to provide advice. We're looking for a best interest standard. But at this point, heads are spinning over how rapid the changes have been.
Yeah, it's pretty tough for big companies and small companies alike to kind of make heads and tails and know what direction they should be moving in. So
yeah, I mean, or even for participants or plan fiduciaries. I mean, one of the things the SEC is trying to address is They want people to know what they're buying. They want to know what the standards, the advice that they're getting are. And really, the only way that you can have people know what they're buying is if kind of the advice standards are stable for a while.
Got it. Kevin, plans for Mother's Day, sir?
So my wife gets her executive MBA from Wharton tomorrow. So I'm heading up to Philadelphia tonight and then coming back to town on Sunday and going out to dinner with my mom.
Awesome.
Well, congratulations.
Enjoy. Yeah. Thanks so much for your time. Well done again, man.
Thanks for having me on.
I'll talk to you next week.
All right. Thanks.
Absolutely.
Bye. Welcome back, everyone. That was Mr. Kevin Walsh from Groom Lawn Group giving us their insight into what's going on with the fiduciary rule. And now we're going to turn our attention to local pensions. There's a great white paper out, which we'll get to in a minute, but I want to introduce our guests. Our first guest is Jean-Pierre Aubry. He is the Associate Director of State and Local Government Research at the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. And also joining us on the line is Dr. Joshua Frenzel. He's the Executive Director of the Center for State and Local Government Excellence. Guys, how are you today?
Very well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the show. So I know we want to talk about the white paper that was authored and really talk that the analysis suggests that public pension cuts may hurt state and local government's ability to recruit workers. And Jean-Pierre, let's start with you in terms of the white paper and what you guys found.
Yeah, thank you. So this paper really, what it found was that pension cuts that we've seen for state and local pensions since the financial crisis have had an impact on recruitment and retention. And so our analysis specifically looked at what does it mean if you cut pensions without any offsetting wage increases. So you basically just shrink the total compensation for employees. And our data found that when those kinds of changes are made, so just pension cuts without other changes to offset those cuts, that you do see a decrease in the competitiveness of state and local employers, meaning that the type of employees that they're able to attract are kind of less competitive in the private sector market.
Yeah, I think, we've been talking about this on the show continuously, that pensions are vital to, obviously, an important part of savings, and mm-hmm. disruption of those pensions could have a drastic impact on services that state and local governments are providing. And it seems that the research really confirms all that. So, I think that kind of, in terms of decision-making, how to support the pension system, I think it kind of, locks in is the right word, but definitely kind of can help steer some of the conversations that many plan sponsors are having about this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, governments are in a tough situation. You know, pension costs are rising, and they are under lots of budget pressure through kind of stagnant revenue growth. And so they're looking for ways to reduce costs while still providing services. And that's what this paper shows is that that cutting pension benefits is not costless. And so that while they may be a necessary reform, that there are impacts in terms of worker quality, in terms of being able to attract good employees and provide good services. And so that any state and local government, a state and local employer considering these kinds of reforms should be aware that there are implications beyond just the cost cutting in terms of attracting employees.
Absolutely. And John, from your perspective, how do you see things? I mean, I know you and I have talked a lot on my previous show and offline about this topic. What do you take away from the study that Jean-Pierre and the team did?
Well, I think, it really aligns with sort of a broader context that I think, I think your listeners might be interested in. When you look at our center, the Center for State and Local Government Excellence, and then also JP's Center for Retirement Research, along with our partners at the National Association of State Retirement Administrators, maintain the public plans database. And I think in a broader context, as looking at it earlier today, when you look at, the good news is employers are paying required contributions to maintain their pension benefits. About 95% of the required contributions were paid back in 2016. But what we're seeing is the portion that these costs are making up of overall payroll. So for example, in 2016, pension costs were making up a little under 17% of payroll. If you rewind back to 2001, they were only making up about 5% of payroll. When you look at like local plans, for example, in the PPD, these pension-required contributions are making up about 31% of payroll costs. And so, like JP was saying, in the absence of increased budget allotments to overall compensation, we're seeing, you know, when we analyze BLS data, that you know wage the portion wages are making up of overall compensation is reducing, while benefit costs related to pensions and healthcare are increasing. Now, putting that in a little broader context, you know, if states and localities are going to be competitive for employees, you know, in an environment where, you know, in April 2018, overall unemployment is about 3.9%, and for those with a college degree or higher is about 2.1%. So you're already in a competitive workforce, a labor force market. How are these governments going to compete against other sectors for talent? And just one other thing before I turn the mic back to you. As you may know, SLGE, along with IPMA, HR, and NASB, does a workforce survey every year, and we're getting ready to release our 2018 workforce report in the next couple of weeks. And we're seeing over there, we do it every year, we ask a question regarding what jobs are you having a hard time filling, you know, over the past year. And with almost without exception, you're seeing the number of jobs increase in terms of having a hard time filling. And then you see year after year, certain positions like policing, engineering, IT, skilled trades, accounting, all being at the top of the list for states and localities having a hard time filling positions for. And, you know, a lot of these positions that I just mentioned require advanced training and education, and governments are competing in a very competitive labor market right now.
Yeah, George, any thoughts on this? I mean, I know this kind of confirms what we've been talking about.
There's not a
perfect solution.
So, am I understanding correctly that state and local governments are having a hard time filling those high skilled positions year over year? And the idea is that, or the reality is that they're not able to compete with bigger companies because they're able to offer more benefits than the governments.
It's not so much benefits. I mean, what our data shows is that it's cuts to compensation. So, and that can come in many forms. It can come in by cuts to wages, cuts to pensions. And what we're showing is that cutting, at least in our report, that cutting pension benefits, so that portion of the compensation package without another offsetting wage increase, is just a cut to compensation like anything else. Hmm. And it has implications for attracting quality employees.
Got it. Which certainly makes
sense.
While at the same time,
you know, these pension benefits are making up a larger portion of overall compensation costs for public employers. And so in the absence of additional budget allocations for increasing overall compensation and wages, governments are going to continue to have a harder time competing for talent.
So is there guidance on what the way forward is? How to actually solve these problems? Is it increased taxes?
I think what our paper tries to show is not so much exactly what the solution is, but just that solutions are undertaken with eyes wide open, right? So that I think the concern sometimes is that pension benefit cuts can be seen as a costless way to reduce the expenses of a government to align it with their revenue, and what this data shows and what our report shows that it's not. And so it doesn't mean it's the wrong answer, but what it does mean is that there are, you know, it's a cost and benefit analysis like anything else, and that it should be understood clearly that pension benefits are meaningful to employees as part of their compensation. Yeah. And so when making that cut, to consider that.
Yeah. I mean, as someone who's been around the table and part of those conversations, I agree. I mean, I think it's so easy to, you know, we get really caught up in our industry at just looking at the numbers, whether it's savings or returns. And it really is a detailed, thoughtful process that you have to go through to understand all the implications, and not just the implications today, but in the implications to the in the future. And I think having this data from all these organizations that are kind of putting this together and keeping it, whether it's NASR, whether it's SLGE, or Boston College, it's important to kind of make sure as a plan sponsor, as people who are wrestling with this issue, so whether you're a constituent, whether you're a legislator, or whether you're the executive director or a staff that's associated with a retirement plan, to make sure you understand the implications of all the changes you're making, and to kind of wrap your head around that and to bake that in to your decision-making process.
Well said. Exactly. These are truly workforce management tools when you get down to it at the end.
Excellent.
Absolutely. Well, guys, hopefully we can have you. We'd love to have you back. So, I mean, great conversation today. We'd love to have you back as you're completing more and more studies. I think, this is an issue that we read about, unfortunately, with pensions. We only get when you read in the popular press, you only get the high level, because, unfortunately, there's not enough length, there's not enough time either to cover it in a segment on a show or to cover it in a periodical. But we'd love to have you on to carry on the conversation if you guys would be open to it.
Absolutely. Yeah, this was fun. Absolutely.
Thanks,
great.
Guys.
Thanks, guys, very much. That's Dr. Joshua Frenzel from the Center for State and Local Government Excellence, and Jean-Pierre Aubry from Boston College's Center for Retirement Research. Guys, have a great weekend and enjoy the nice weather.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, guys. Take care. Bye.
You too. Bye.
Welcome back. That was an awesome segment from Dr. Joshua Frenzel and Dr. Jean-Pierre Aubry talking about the current challenges that pensions are facing all across the country and some things that can be done about it. So joining us now is Jacob Passy, personal finance reporter with MarketWatch. How's it going, Jacob?
It's going well.
Excellent. Happy Friday. And I was going through some of your work as of late, and I saw a really interesting piece about the National Anxiety Score and how Americans are more anxious than ever, and certainly money plays a big part in that.
Yes, yeah. So people are getting increasingly anxious, and the national score jumped by 5 points from a year ago when it comes to people's worries overall, but the biggest jump was seen in terms of financial anxiety. About two-thirds of respondents to a poll done by the American Psychiatric Association said they were either extremely or somewhat anxious about paying their bills or expenses, and that was up from just 56% last year. So people are getting way more concerned about finances, it turns out.
And it's interesting, we were talking a little bit earlier, I had a conversation earlier this week with somebody talking about the practice of contentment, and we don't need to rehash that, but fundamentally, I think that a lot of the times people get themselves in financial difficulties because they're looking for some instant gratification, and I think that we'll talk about that a little bit further, but that just causes people to overspend, and when they overspend, then they have to worry about their bills.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing, consumer debt levels are hitting all-time records, for a variety of reasons. People are using credit cards more and things like that. And, having debt isn't inherently bad, but it is when you don't have, the income or means to, pay off that debt over time. So, and there's an extent to which, people's anxiety, that doesn't just worry. It also, can impact your performance at work. And there are studies that show that about three-quarters of Americans say that, mental illness has a significant effect on the economy itself. So, people are aware that, their mental health impacts their ability to, be financially savvy and sound. And so it's kind of a cyclical issue in that sense.
Yeah, I think we. I, I'm sorry, George. I was going to say that I think you see some of those numbers play out in the consumer sentiment numbers that we see, and they kind of have followed. They've kind of tracked the volatility in the market in some respects. I think, you know, we've talked a lot on this show about 401k balances really swelling when the Dow hit 26,000, and you know, people were being braggadocious, saying how big their 401k balances got, as an example. And then when things kind of took a hit, when you had more volatility, I think that's some of that's really ebbed, of course, and you see the consumer sentiment kind of drop. And obviously, when you see it and read it and talk about it, all that kind of plays into your psyche. So I think it's
totally.
You got to have that long term perspective. I think we talk about this endlessly on the show, but I think, you know, between all of us talking, we always talk about that long term perspective and thinking about things well into the future. So sorry, I'll get off my soapbox now, but you just made me kind of think about how it all kind of ties in too.
And Jacob, I know that Allie had written a piece about how Americans are feeling about their retirements. I don't know if you can touch a little bit on that.
Totally, yeah. So, about half of Americans do expect that they will be comfortable in their retirement from a financial perspective based on a poll that was taken by Gallup, but 46% said that they don't think they will be financially comfortable when they retire. And that is much higher than when Gallup first began tracking sentiment regarding retirement preparedness before the Great Recession back in 2002-2004. Around then, it was only around a third of non-retirees who were worried about being comfortable financially in retirement. So, you know, a growing number of Americans are concerned about that. This is kind of an issue I think we've all been tracking for a while, is that, you know, people aren't saving enough for retirement, and at least it seems like they're aware of it, but that doesn't necessarily mean they know, you know, what tools they need to fix that.
Yeah, and once we figure that out, we'll all be wealthy people, but something tells me that we have a spending problem in America that's really leading to our savings problem, so... I know that one of the things, and I'm going to just reiterate it, that instant gratification is probably to blame for Americans' inability to be putting away more money.
Yeah. I mean, and you hear these scary statistics. One of the statistics Allie mentioned in the piece was that one in three Americans have less than $5,000 saved for retirement, according to a study from Northwestern Mutual. Less than $5,000. It's a scary figure when, especially when people are living longer and longer.
No doubt about it. So, Jacob, are you ready for Mother's Day?
I am. I've got my gift already purchased. I've got the card. I'm all set, ready to go.
Excellent. Jeff, are you ready? I don't even know if I've asked.
Oh, you didn't ask, but yeah, actually, I'm in Baltimore right now. I just saw my mother. I'm actually in her home, and I gave her flowers when I walked in the door. I'm with my fiance. I think I've talked about getting married, so we're here to do some wedding planning. And I gave we gave my mom some. I probably am opening up too much on the show. Maybe we should have a separate segment about wedding planning. But yeah, I'm all good and caught up. And then tomorrow night I'm having dinner with my stepmother and my father. So I'm going to have it all checked off.
Yeah, sounds like you're doing a great job.
But thanks for asking. How about yourself? How about yourself, George?
Yeah.
Are you ready with your wife?
Yeah, I'm absolutely ready. I would never wait until the last minute to buy any kind of a gift or a card or anything like that.
No, never, never.
And I'm lying. I'm ill prepared. Give me something to do later today. So.
Well, you know, Dan, I just say before we tie things on with Jacob, but Jacob, I always appreciate you guys coming on the show. And we've got our first Roads to Retirement segment that George is going to be leading next. Next segment, we've got a band coming on, Shakedown Suite, with a music, also doing a musical performance. The Gallup survey that you talked about, we're actually going to talk to the band about their perceptions about retirement and savings. And I think we're going to hear, quote unquote, from the horse's mouth. So that should be a pretty interesting segment, our first of hopefully many.
I love it.
Yeah, definitely.
Jacob, thanks so much.
Take care. Thank you
so much. Thanks, Jake. Have a good weekend.
Welcome back, everybody. That was Jacob Passy from MarketWatch. And now we are launching a brand new segment that we're extremely excited about. And we've got with us some of the members of the band Shakedown Suite. We've got Jeff, who is the lead singer. We've got Chris, who is the percussionist, and Shane, the lead guitarist. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good to be here, obviously.
So it's been quite a while since the band has played together. What motivated getting back together?
Music, the way we kind of always approach music is it's been kind of a conversation, and you kind of just pick up. We've known each other for such a long time that you just kind of pick up where you kind of left off, and you know, we all go through different phases of life where we're dealing with different things, get caught up in work or get caught up in, you know, personal life. And I had reached out to the guys, and we'd had some email conversations, and you know, it just seemed like it was the right time and place to kind of get together and play. And I miss these guys tremendously. We had a lot of interaction when I lived here in Baltimore. And then even when I moved to New York, we were playing in various incarnations of the band. So I reached out, and everyone was kind of into it.
That's awesome.
It's always fun to get back together. And in the format that we play in sort of a jam band format or the Grateful Dead format, it doesn't necessarily require a whole lot of practice, just to come together for fun and have a few beers and just jam and have a good time.
That sounds pretty good to me. So what does music and playing together mean to you guys?
I guess I can answer that. For me, myself, I play with several different groups currently, but getting together with a group of guys and playing music, it's just a different level or different form of communication. You're not actually speaking to one another, but you're kind of speaking to each other through music, and it's really good. It's really therapeutic. Especially after a long work week, it's good to get together with some friends and just relax and play some great tunes that you've always loved playing. And I've always enjoyed playing with Chris and Jeff in that format.
How about you, Chris?
And to me, a lot of the bands that I play in, I've never necessarily done it for the money. I've always done it because I have a joy of performing in front of people. And I've met a lot of different people, and in different bands, you have different sort of levels of brotherhood. The commonality of the music that we all share kind of brings us together in a different way. And as Shane said, there's really no need for a lot of practice. We have such a common love of similar music. When we come together, we feel all that, and we really feel the brotherhood. But that's one of the reasons why I like playing with these guys the most, is because we've all been playing a long time, and we can come together and do that with very little practice. And I can feel that brotherhood is there, and that's really nice.
Yeah. That's awesome.
And like I said, it is kind of a conversation, and no matter where you are, you can always come back to where the conversation was and pick it back up. And it's amazing, the chemistry. You know when you just kind of hit it off with people. And you had this chemistry that develops, and for us and the group, not just the three of us, but everyone, we have this great chemistry that exists, and it just allows for the free flow of communication and ideas, and I think you always kind of cherish that, and so it's easier to come back to.
Yeah, and I'd add too that with the level of musicianship amongst the three of us and the rest of the group, quite frankly, without being together for a number of years, we could have probably gone out at any time without any practice and sounded better than some of the groups I've played in the past. We just have that level of a relationship musically and personally that we can just get together on a moment's notice, and we could play a gig if we had a place to play.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
That's very cool. So you guys, I have to assume, have been musicians probably throughout the course of your lives. How has your music changed over as you've gotten a little older? Because for example, I'm not a musician, but I love music, and I've kind of gone the opposite way. I used to hate pop music, but as I've gotten a little bit older, I enjoy it more. And I don't know if I should get some kind of an MRI completed, but just I know that our musical tastes change throughout. Just as we get older, so
yeah. I think for me, I just have evolved in and listening to different types of music. Even when I was younger, I just try not to, lock myself into specific things. You know, I always loved classic rock. I always loved like hippie rock and jam rock and things like that. But I've always been a lover of jazz. I really loved classical music when I was real young, in my kind of middle to late teens. I listened to a lot of college radio, and I used to listen to a lot of new age programs, some which are still on to this day, going on, I guess, like 30 years. So I've always tried to just pull from different things. And I always considered myself as a musician to be a listener. And I think it's one of the most important things you can do. And so whether you're playing with other guys or you're sitting down listening to new music, it's just so important to me to listen and take things that you hear. And, you know, you can use them when you play with other people, or when you're playing with other people, you listen to what everyone else is doing. And that kind of helps me know where I'm going to go next on the drums, what I'm going to do and what type of feel I'm going to give. So I think in general, my musical tastes haven't changed. I just try and not turn anything down and say, you know, all that music is junk or anything like that, because I believe you can pull from everywhere and gain something.
Chris makes a great point there. When I speak to younger musicians or even my daughter or nieces and nephews that are starting to get into music, I tell them not to discount any music that comes your way. You know, I've been exposed to everything from jam band music to rap music growing up, you know, classic rock. So I've taken a little bit of something from all those different genres. While I may not be a rapper or do that style of music, there is different things rhythmically or other things that you can infuse into the music that you're playing. And for me personally, I probably am the least well-versed musically out of everyone. For as much as I love playing music, I hate to say that I don't listen to a whole lot of music. And growing up, I kind of evolved by listening to the kind of the core bands that everyone listens to. Of course, the Beatles and Pink Floyd was a huge influence on me. And I know Chris and I have a shared love of Pink Floyd, and hope to someday get together with him and play some of that stuff again. But I've always kind of stuck to the core things. And then through the years, I did evolve into more of the kind of what some people would refer to as alternative country bands, like Wilco, Uncle Tupelo, Jayhawks, things like that. So which kind of is full circle, because doing the Grateful Dead thing like the three of us do, certainly there was a period where the Dead could have been considered alt country. So while I wouldn't say I've evolved a lot, I'd say where I've evolved is in actually my performance or my playing. And another good point that Chris brings up is the listening part of it too, which is taking me a long time as a musician to while I'm playing, sit back and listen to the other musicians and not play over top of them. It's more about playing with them.
Hmm. Well, I certainly respect and appreciate that. And I know that for me, music really marks time. And I think that when I hear certain songs, it'll bring me back to the time and the place when I was listening to it a lot. And certainly a major variable or a major important part of my life. And as I make this transition into personal finance, money is certainly such an integral part of our lives, whether we want it to be or not. And it can certainly be a force for good or can be a force for bad. So I'm just always curious to get you guys' thoughts and input on how money has sort of changed and evolved throughout the course of your lives for you personally.
I think for me personally, it's evolved kind of differently and maybe kind of evolved a little bit backwards. I came from a middle-class family who were very interested in saving every penny that they had. So I started off pretty young with a job at 15, you know, cutting grass and things like that. And I literally saved every penny, put it in an old jar and had savings that way. And I was very frugal up through my 20s, and then just with life and experiencing life and listening to other people saying you can't take it with you and that kind of thing, I've been less frugal and willing to go out and do more things with my money. But that being said, I still am very interested in, you know, looking forward to a retirement where I will be secure. And, you know, I have a good position now, and I've been in my profession for about 17 years. And so I've always, throughout those 17 years, been
putting money away, whether it be through government plans or my own personal savings. So I've kind of evolved backwards from being very frugal to being not so frugal, but still investing and looking at my future.
Yeah, and I guess I have sort of a similar story. I grew up middle class family and out in the country, northern Maryland, and I was working on farms as early as 14, and worked really hard to get to save away some money, but didn't really have much savings, and my parents obviously helped me out here and there. Once I left college, I ended up working at a large market retirement plan record keeper, and that really kind of gave me my first view into what it was like to be saving. This was before Y2K, and really the market was booming. It was dollar for dollar retirement plan matching, and I really just did my best to put as much as I could in there. And really saw how it grew and saw what a benefit it was. I was there for about 10 years, and then I've worked in funeral service for over a decade now as well, and had the opportunity to do a similar thing with regards to my saving while I've been in funeral service. So how that kind of ties back into music is, well, I bought my first drum set for $450 in 1991. And I sold it just last year in 2017 because I finally felt like I was in a place financially where I could go out and buy the actual drum set that I wanted. And so that was a really nice thing. It's a nice thing to kind of see your savings, after so many years come to fruition and you be in a place financially where you can go and buy that thing in the window that you had kind of always wanted to buy as a kid. And never did, and never had the finances to do so. So
that's awesome.
And if you're doing it right, sometimes those drum kits and guitars can be a savings plan in and of their own. Mm-hmm. If they're worth something later on.
Well, actually, I sold my first drum set that I bought for $450. I bought it in 1991. It was a 1981, and when I sold it last year, I sold it for pretty much double what I had bought it for. Actually, to a mutual friend of Shane and I's, so it did very well. And I took very good care of it as well. But that was an investment that lasted me for many, many years, and so it was nice to actually make money on it and not lose it. And you got to take that money and put it forward into new equipment.
I love it.
So George, just an editorial comment. Isn't that music to your ears? I mean, to hear. I mean, we're all about the same age, but I mean, to hear the kind of the forward thinking and the looking down the road, and that's kind of that. As much as the surveys tell us that people aren't thinking that way, and there are many Americans who aren't, there are people who are thinking that way, and this is two examples of thinking the quote unquote the right way.
I love it for sure. It is, in fact, music to my ears.
So I don't know. You guys want to do a number? We can maybe close out on a number. We can play on the show.
Sure.
So I figured it's May, and if since we do Grateful Dead cover, we've covered Grateful Dead music. You guys remember that 19? Maybe don't remember it because you were probably only five or six. But you remember that 1977 Spring Run that the Dead made was amazing, especially. The May 8th Cornell show, and we would do, that was a great, a lot of energy coming from the band, and maybe we could do Scarlet Begonias and The Fire on the Mountain. What do you guys say?
Sounds good.
Sounds great.
All right, George, well, thank you so much. We're gonna close out the show with a tune.
Thanks a lot, Shane. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Thanks, George. Thank you.
isn't it the way?